I'm Bruce Evans. I'm the EMS chief for the City of North Las Vegas Fire Department. 22-year-plus consistently nationally registered paramedic, and just still have a passion for this job.
Awesome.
There's, I think the story I'd like to relate to students is, I call it the circle of life, or a circle of life similar to the EMS profession. A couple of years ago, after I'd gone to the fire department, an old partner of mine who I used to work with at private ambulance called me up and said, hey, the dispatch center from private ambulance called me today and said, there's some girl in town who says we picked her sister up about 5 or 6 years ago and took her to the hospital, and she wants to talk to us. So immediately, what do you think when somebody tells you that?
Uh-oh.
That's exactly right. So, and you start thinking back to the curriculum, and you start thinking back to your EMT book, your paramedic book, and thinking, well, what is the statute of limitations all about? And what's it take to get sued? Do you have to have a breach of, you know, duty to act? And does there have to be causation?
What was the requirement to prove negligence again?
Yeah. And then I'm thinking to myself, well, geez, you know, I worked on the Las Vegas Strip for 2.5 years, and you know, the volume there is just incredible, and you see a lot of fantastic calls there. So I said, he was telling me, well, yeah, it was some call where the girl's sister was pregnant. She was an auto pedestrian accident in front of the Stardust Hotel. And I said, well, I really don't remember that well. I said, it seems like, you know, we ran an awful lot of accidents in front of the Stardust there. But he says, well, who's going to call her? Are you going to call her, or am I going to call her? And I said, well, do you think we should call her? You know, we don't have lawyers. And he says, well, it didn't sound like it was really legal in nature. So I said, you know, why don't we just, you know, draw straws, or we'll do paper, scissors, rock over the phone here and see what happens. So anyway, he wound up making the phone call. And it turns out that it wasn't anything negative at all. It turns out that this girl had come back into town. And the story that she tells with this, and again, after she refreshed our memory on the story, we certainly remember it, but my partner was an EMT intermediate, so he was the driver at the time, but this girl had been brushed by a car in the entry to the Stardust Hotel. And the car just really kind of caught her behind the mirror and spun her around, knocked her down, but nonetheless, it was treated as an auto ped. And I was the paramedic that night, and it just turns out that this lady at the time was like 6 or 7 months pregnant. So with that kind of mechanism of injury, we went ahead and put her on the backboard and put a line in her precautionary wise and monitored her vital signs and took her over to the local trauma center. But during the time of the transport, my partner was up front kind of explaining to her sister, you know, everything that was going on. And, you know, she was kind of poking her head around the corner and looking in the back and saw, you know, that we had her sister covered up, and then, you know, all the humanistic things were going on back there, because it was kind of a low priority call. You know, we were talking to her, trying to calm her down, you know, joking with her a little bit, take her mind off her injuries. In the meantime, my partner was explaining everything to her and the facility they were going to, and continuously reassuring the sister. Well, it turns out that she was so impressed with the care that she got and that her sister got at that time, that when she got back to Wisconsin, where she was originally from or visiting from, she changed her major from accounting to nursing and went and took an EMT class, and had since gone on to become like a cross-trained flight nurse paramedic at one of the local air ambulance services there on the up in upper Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And she had gone on to become an EMS instructor, and all this within 5 years' time.
Wow.
And she went on to start every one of her EMT classes with telling the story about how she got into the EMS profession by her experience in Las Vegas at that time. And then she went on to tell us that the kid that the sister was pregnant with at the time was born without any complications, and he's the jewel of the family. You know, he's brings everybody a lot of smiles and a lot of you know, joy. Mm-hmm. So I was starting to think back on that. And why I call this the circle of life story is that, you know, I'd like to say that I used to pride myself in the ability to talk to people when they were injured, and that whole piece that you see so many new students, or you see so many paramedics get in the back, and instead of actually communicating with their patients during the transport, you know, they're more in a hurry to get out the clipboard and start filling out their paperwork, and that long silent ride that occurs between the scene in the hospital, right, a lot of times makes the patient uncomfortable or really cut, you know, they have their fears and their questions that they would probably like to ask, but they never really engage the attendant or the medic. And I don't think I really ever had that situation. I was always able to find some way to converse with people and take their mind off of whatever their injuries were, mm-hmm, you know, whether it was asking them where they were from and stuff. But where I learned that, and where I learned all those issues about patients aren't just chest pain, or they're not just auto peds, or, you know, they're not whatever other, you know, category of medical injury you want to put them into, that they're all really human beings, is that early on in my career as an EMT intermediate back in Des Moines, Iowa, I had the pleasure of being a volunteer flight attendant with LifeFlight out of Des Moines. And I was able to do that as an EMT intermediate, which very few people actually have had that opportunity, I think, to be pulled into a flight service as a partner with the flight nurses, you know, at 21 or 20 years old, yeah, at that time. And one of the things that all those flight nurses had really told me and really instilled on me, particularly one in general, a gal named Kathy O'Brien, who was the chief flight nurse at LifeFlight Des Moines, was all about the issues about human suffering and what it's like to be a patient and what, how people's feelings are really more important than really what their illnesses are. Because a lot of the, we don't have a lot of answers to people's illnesses, but we do have a lot of answers to human contact and to what is really the art of medicine, which is the laying of hands or the healing piece that comes with really just taking care of people and trying to put them at ease mentally. So again, this kind of comes full circle a little bit to say that my particular skills and abilities that come with the humanistic piece, and again, realizing that they're people and they're not just chest pain or an auto ped, comes from a flight nurse who instilled that on me. And then from my experiences and my actions in the field, later on that turned around to send somebody else into the flight nurse profession, who is now starting her EMT classes every year with that particular story.
Right.
So it's kind of that piece about, again, coming full circle about somebody planting a seed in somebody, and here 10 or 15 years later, that seed gets planted in somebody else and it continues the tradition.
Yeah. That really seems to speak to the mentor-student relationship.
Absolutely.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's been a big deal, I think, to try to get people to converse. And again, that piece about breaking down the barriers of, you know, what really is patient care about. Mm-hmm. And the mentorship piece is, you know, I can't say enough about the flight nurses that taught me all that, you know, and that's obviously a high stress position. There's a lot of turnover in those roles. And, you know, that's probably for a big reason, is that not only as healthcare providers, but certainly as mentors, I think you see a lot of flight services provide those kind of services to folks, and certainly give a lot to them of themselves. You know, and I've always tried to continue to do that, as not only as an EMS chief, I've always been an educator. Matter of fact, I've probably been in the fire service about the same length of time that I've been an educator at the community college. And, you know, this is that's always been a big milestone. I guess I achieved a milestone in the last couple of years, because now I'm getting people that I had as a students 20 years ago, I'm getting their kids that are coming through. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, you kind of sit back and look at your career and think about how many people that you actually had some influence on,
right,
as far as their careers go. And then the number of people that I see that are either in promotional ranks or that are through paramedic training that are coming through either being hired or being promoted that were my students at one time. You know, and certainly, you know, the number of kids that you felt like you were, that you get a lot of results out of mentoring, you know, those are a little bit fewer and far between. And, you know, that's the one thing that I think people don't understand, is that as you get into all the stuff with didactics and clinicals and ride-alongs and stuff, it's really important for you to find a mentor. And it's really important that, you know, maybe that mentor isn't necessarily your instructor, but it might be a field medic that's really experienced, that has a little piece of wisdom or something in commonality with you that you can go develop that relationship with. And I had a lot of good mentors through my career. And I have a lot of good mentors right now. You know, I would say that Jim Page was a good mentor to me as far as my management skills go and my leadership ability, or looking at, you know, being involved with national operations. And mm-hmm. all the way back to the first paramedic senior paramedic I ever rode with as a student, as a basic EMT, a guy named Lee Thomas, who had come from the military, but had saw something in me that he thought I was going to be a good medic, and put a lot of extra effort and a lot of extra time in for me, and also put a lot of additional challenges to me to make sure that I continued to raise the bar on my own expectations and his expectations. So,
right. Getting back to that sort of the bedside manner that you were talking about, you said that you were always easy to talk to people. You found that easy. How much of that bedside manner do you think is, did you learn skills that helped improve your interactions? And, you know, was a lot of it based on what you brought to it? Or do you think people can learn?
Well, I think that's the thing that this day and age, you always see a lot of students and I see this particularly huge problem in the fire service-based EMS, is that a lot of people get frustrated with people anymore. You know, they call basically because they're kind of at the end of their rope, and a lot of what we go on anymore is really social issues, but we're people's last hope. You know, we're the safety net. So they dial into the 911 system and, you know, they're depressed, or they have a small cut that's a big emergency to them, but not a big emergency to us. And a lot of times what people don't understand is that the one great thing about this job is that it really exposes you to the human condition, you know. And if there's one thing that makes you feel alive, is the fact that, you know, you're there and you get to share other people's emotions, and you get to share their triumphs, you get to share their tragedies. And even though some of it may be absolutely catastrophic and horrific, the fact that you can feel it, you know, really puts a lot into the issue about, you know, what an emotional job this is. And, you know, over the course of many years, it does take its toll. It's up and down a lot. And it's, you know, there are some catastrophic things that will happen to you in this career, but you just got to, you know, realize that you don't do it to those people, and that, you know, you still got to stay engaged. You can't depersonalize people. You can't depersonalize yourself or let yourself go down that track. And by communicating with people and having those rich experiences where, you know, like just a couple years ago, I picked a lady up that had fractured a hip. She was in her late 70s, early 80s. But I know she had a British accent. So I started asking her, well, you know, from Britain? And she says, yes, I'm from London. And I said, well, how long you been here? She says, oh, I came over after the war. And, you know, I married one of you American blokes. And I laughed about that. And I said, well, what'd you do when you were there? And she says, well, I was in the British SAS. And I said, oh, you're a secret agent. She says, well, I wasn't really that secret. She says, but I was one of the first people to type on the Enigma machine. So, I mean, there's just an incredible amount of history, especially in the, you know, the greatest generation people, that a lot of people will miss if they don't actually get a chance to, you know. And the whole time, you know, I was giving her morphine and she had a line in and was monitoring pressure to make sure there wasn't any hypotension that was associated with what turned out to be a pretty significant hip fracture.
Right.
And knowing statistically that probably in about 18 months that she wasn't going to do very well. And then obviously a fracture of that nature has got a pretty high mortality rate with somebody that's that old. And also she was had an underlying history of diabetes. So, but nonetheless, I'll never forget her. So,
yeah. And so that, you know, but again, just getting back to the, is it something you can learn? Do you think, have you seen a student that maybe had a bad bedside manner and then you were able to, like, I don't know, nudge them in the right direction or coach them, or is it kind of a lost cause?
No, I think that, you know, it's kind of like, it's kind of like a cocktail party a little bit, man. You know, people will grow up being wallflowers, you know, and it just takes one person to kind of get out there and decide that they're going to dance or that they're going to start a conversation. And then it typically becomes contagious. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times what I would have to do is I would have to start the conversation with students that I was either precepting or mentoring. And then they would, they would start to get into the conversation.
Right.
So we'd start a thing, and in Las Vegas, nobody is from Las Vegas. So it's always, even if they're residents there and you're picking them up, they're probably moved there from somewhere else. So it was always a great,
you guys have it easy then.
It was always a great thing to open it up and say, well, you know, where are you from originally, you know?
Yeah, right.
And people would say, oh, I'm from Cleveland, or I'm from Miami, or I'm from Slovenia, you know, or I moved here from Russia recently. And you would get that rich history, which is always, you know, like I said, it was unique about Las Vegas. But, or, you know, sometimes, you know, certainly when I was back in the Midwest and working in Des Moines, there was a lot of times where you would ask people if they grew up in Des Moines, or, you know, and what they did, or what their families did, or one of the, you know, I used to love to ask probably three questions, because a lot of times one of the real benefits, I think, of being able to care for the greatest generation of people, or that golden generation, is you find a lot of people that have been married for 50 or 60 years. One of the things I always used to ask, kind of those three questions, I'd say, well, you know, how long you've been married? And, you know, some people say, oh, 50 years or 60 years. And I'd say, well, you know, gosh, what's the secret to that? And you kind of get about three of the same answers. You'd get, never go to bed mad. And it was amazing, no matter where the, their backgrounds were from, or what kind of diversity they had in their life, you would hear that very routinely. It's never go to bed mad. And you'd hear it from both husbands and wives. The other one you'd hear is that, you know, just give people their space, let them be who they are. And there would be, you know, they talk about, you know, if they want to go out in the garage and tinker with their car, you let them go. If they want to watch their football game, you let them go. If they want to go to their sewing circle, you let them go and do their thing. You let them still maintain their individuality. And then the third question, you know, the other third thing that they would say a lot of times, you kind of get a varying answer. You'd get a lot of the men saying, well, it's a little different now. You know, women are in the workplace and there's a lot more choices. Or you'd hear the women say that, well, you know, there's a lot of stability that comes with a relationship, and you've got family and kids, and there's nothing better than being around your family and kids, especially during the holidays. Mm-hmm. And those two answers would kind of vacillate back and forth for the third comment on that. But it was always good to hear people's stories. So,
yeah.
And again, the fact that, you know, what, you know, a little pearls of wisdom about how to stay married more than 50 years or 60 years, if you're lucky enough to see some of those folks.
Right. What was your third question? Where are you from? How long you've been married?
Yeah. And then you'd ask them what they did, you know, and somebody, you'd find all kinds of people with very interesting backgrounds, especially in Las Vegas. And you would find that, you know, you'd find somebody that worked on the show, you know, that was there back when Bugsy Siegel was, you know, running the Flamingo.
Right.
Or you'd find people that knew, you know, mobsters, you know, or had, you know, always, there was one gentleman who, for the longest time, we had gone back to his house several times because he had a chronic illness and he was dying. And this particular guy had run probably one of the most famous mob restaurants in Las Vegas for a long time, Francesco's. And he had owned like this little deli that was in the mall that like all the mob people came for their sandwiches. And he had this special, you know, every time I'd transport him, I'd always ask him about some of his secret recipes, because that's one thing he never did, is he never wrote down his menu. Historically, all the mob people just knew to come in there and order this or order that.
Right.
They were that familiar with his, or they would order for their entourage that was with them. So Francesco never wrote that menu down. So as he was getting really sick and he kind of knew he was going, he left the crew that I was with when we picked him up, kind of the last time we saw him. Mm-hmm. He told us about one particular dish that he thought that we should cook at the station and pass that off to us, which it's a scampi that's rolled up in chicken parmesan.
Ooh.
So, which, you know, those are both great Italian dishes, but you never would think to mix them.
Yeah.
So, and he said that that was one of them that all the bosses liked a lot. So.
That's great.
Open Airways podcasts are produced by FizDap with support from emsresponder.com. All recordings express the opinions and experience of the speaker and do not constitute legal or medical advice. This and other recordings can be found at www.openairways.net.